Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Hi there, and welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist, show number 006, Election Palooza. Today, we will, as always, break down local and other economic news, then discuss some of the economic issues involved in the presidential race, you may have heard of that, as well as the congressional race between incumbent Chris Gibson and challenger Julian Schreibman. Finally, we'll hear my interview with Hudson City Alderman John Friedman, in which we discuss the housing situation in Hudson and the recent meeting held to talk about some of the issues about landlord-tenant relations. Thanks for tuning in. What's new? The most talked about economic news of the past month is, of course, the jobs numbers that came out the Friday after the first presidential debate, during which, incredibly, no mention was made by the president of his opponent's not-quite-so-private-as-he-thought-at-the-time 47% remark. The unemployment rate fell to 7.8% in September nationally, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Of course, the president claimed the small drop was a sign that things are getting better, while his opponent said that they are too little for the people of this country, so the president's policies aren't clearly working. So much for politics and politicians. Listeners of this show know by now that 1 month of data are really not a trend, and that you need to look at least 3 month averages or at least year-to-year changes for any real sense of what's going on. The trend has been positive, however, nationally, with slow unemployment growth on average. Recovery of the employment in the private, that is the non-governmental sector, has been pretty good, which is to say faster than the anemic growth out of the previous recession during George Bush's presidency. Not saying much, really. But if government employment had not been falling so sharply as a result of a lack of state support from the federal government during the recession, the situation would certainly be less bleak than it is now, especially in schools around the country. Locally, the jobs picture also improved slightly, with similar increases in employment and drops in unemployment in August in both Greene and Columbia counties, though both are still about 0.8% higher than the same time last year in terms of unemployment rate. Columbia's unemployment rate is the same as the nation as a whole at 7.8%, while Greene's is the same as the statewide rate of 9.1%. Getting back to the situation at the state and local level in terms of government employment, we continue to see a stream of stories in the papers about local governments either cutting staff or raising taxes. Neither of these are popular, whether it's cuts to youth programs in Hudson due to cuts in state support for youth programs, or the 10% across-the-board cuts being proposed in the city of Hudson's budget. The latter is due, we read, to $883,322 in pension costs for 2013, up from $771,000 for 2012. Listeners may remember me talking about the underreported impact of the financial crisis on state and local budgets through the channel of the damage caused by the crisis to pension funds across the country. So whenever you hear increase in pension costs, think ongoing fallout from this financial crisis. Other towns like Stuyvesant are facing tax increases. In Stuyvesant's case, the increase are due to the need to pay back bonds for a public works project. Bonds, as you may know, are simply a form of loan. Instead of going to a bank and signing an agreement to repay a loan like you or I might do for a car or a house, governments, both local and national, as well as businesses, borrow directly from the public by selling bonds, which are simply promises to repay the loan with interest. There's no mention in the story of whether higher interest payments, as a result of, you guessed it, the financial crisis, are a factor. I have a hunch they are. But it does tell us that additional factors are increases in health insurance and retirement contribution expenses. Healthcare costs are a subject for an upcoming show, but where have we heard that one about retirement costs before? A rare exception to this pattern seems to be Catskill, which is lowering taxes and raising spending in the proposed budget submitted by Town Supervisor Joseph Leggio. Not sure what's going on there. Hope to have more on that for you next time. All right, now let's turn to elections. I'm mostly going to talk about the presidential elections, and this will be a little more ranty than usual. But bear with me, and hopefully we'll all learn something anyway. So in terms of the economy and the election, the choices between the two major party candidates for election to the presidency or to the Congress are roughly the same. Incumbent Congressman Chris Gibson voted for the Ryan budget plan passed by the House of Representatives, which is probably more harsh than the Romney plan, although with the specifics that Romney and Ryan have so far refused to divulge on both the spending and taxes sides, it's hard to say, really. As I mentioned last time, the Romney plan for the economy really boils down to the wonder of tax cuts for all, and therefore jobs for all. It's entirely unclear to me how we get from point A to point B in this case, though. The argument for the Romney plan is that tax cuts will lead to economic growth, and therefore jobs. Sometimes economists will add in the long run, in the verbal equivalent of fine print. Romney has an impressive list of economists saying these things for him, such as former George W. Bush economic advisor, Harvard's Greg Mankiw, author of one of the most widely used college introductory economics textbooks. The argument goes that since taxes reduce the amount of profits capitalists can make, right, it reduces their incentive to invest, so they will invest less, which means that growth will be slower, since investment means newer technology, higher productivity, growth. However, a Congressional Research Service study failed to find any effect of top tax rates, the ones that are supposedly too high and affecting growth negatively. It's worth quoting the report here. Quote, "The results of the analysis suggest that changes over the past 65 years in the top marginal tax rate and the top capital gains tax rate do not appear correlated with economic growth. The reduction in the top tax rates appears to be uncorrelated with savings, investment, and productivity growth. The top tax rates appear to have little or no relation to the size of the economic pie. However, the top tax rate reductions appear to be associated with the increasing concentration of income at the top of the income distribution. As measured by IRS data, the share of income accruing to the top 0.1% of U.S. families increased from 4.2% in 1945 to 12.3% by 2007, before falling to 9.2% due to the 2007-2009 recession. At the same time, the average tax rate paid by the top 0.1% fell from over 50% in 1945 to about 25% in 2009. Tax policy could have a relation to how the economic pie is sliced. Lower top tax rates may be associated with greater income disparities." End quote. Indeed. The theory itself doesn't really pass the laugh test. We are meant to suppose that the people with money to invest will do nothing with their money if the highest tax rate is too high. They'll not invest it in some sort of fit of spitefulness, or they'll go galt with their money, as the libertarian acolytes of Ayn Rand, like Paul Ryan, would say. They'll simply not make profitable investments that they would have made if not for that pesky tax rate. It's inconceivable that economists who constantly argue that people perfectly maximize their own welfare will suggest that people with money will rather earn zero return on their money than investing it, simply because of a higher tax rate. If the top rate was 100%, I could see the logic of the argument. In that case, somebody with $1 million to invest would be equally well off whether he invested or not. But if the rate is less than that, then not investing their money means that the person with $1 million is leaving that money on the table. Not a habit that will earn you $1 million, I'm led to understand. So I really don't get the theory. It doesn't make sense. The president's plan, as I've mentioned before, is not in his campaign materials, as he's made multiple proposals and submitted a budget every year. The specifics of the taxes in that plan we discussed last time. The specifics of the spending are basically modest increases as stimulus. Unfortunately, the measures we've seen so far from the president have not been enough to reverse the tide completely. And unfortunately, since there have been no consequences for Wall Street for ruining the economy and little in terms of effective regulation put in place, we're due eventually to have another financial crisis. Differences in terms of Social Security and Medicare do exist. Julian Schreibman has been attacking Gibson on this issue, touting his support for a voucher system to replace Medicare. He voted for the Ryan plan. While it's true that this characterization may be a bit unfair, It's also true that one of the major parties has opposed Social Security since its beginnings in the Great Depression, and that that same party has opposed Medicare and Medicaid as well. That is Gibson's party, and whether or not their plan meets the technical definition of voucher or not, the plan is to get rid of these programs. The only reason they've not been more vocal about that goal is that it is perceived as political suicide. You see, that's just not very popular. So we have a reasonable approach to the supposed problems with these so-called entitlement programs. So-called reasonable approach. Remember candidate Romney's secretly recorded remarks about the 47% that feel entitled to food and health care? The nerve of them. The truth is that Social Security is not in danger of bankruptcy, as the candidates say and the press breathlessly and uncritically repeats. If nothing is done to Social Security, it will continue to pay 100% of its benefits for decades, after which it will pay 75% of its benefits. A small fix is all that's required to make Social Security whole for the foreseeable future. A slight increase in the tax rate, or increasing the top amount that can be taxed. As many of you know, the way that income is taxed at this point is that for the payroll tax that covers Social Security, only the first 100,000 or so of your income is taxed. After that, it's payroll tax-free. Getting rid of that cap would fix any problem that Social Security has entirely. Medicare, of course, is a different story, and it is in trouble financially, but not because of any problem with the program itself, but rather because of healthcare costs, which continue to have uncontrolled increases in the U.S., as well as things like the fact that a huge benefit was added to the program by the last administration. That's Medicare Part D, the drugs coverage, which was unpaid for, and which Mr. Serious Fiscal Conservative himself, Paul Ryan, congressman from Wisconsin, voted for. Not much fiscal seriousness there. And it was set up so that Medicare itself was not allowed to negotiate drugs prices, so it couldn't get a volume discount. The largest single buyer of drugs in the country not allowed to get a volume discount. Of course, the pharmaceutical companies could volunteer to give Medicare a discount. Spoilers, they don't. So Medicare has funding problems because the U.S. healthcare system as a whole has funding problems. Whether or not we have Medicare, the U.S. system as a whole is becoming less and less affordable, at least if the goal is to have everybody get healthcare. Of course, Medicare is still cheaper to operate than private insurance companies, which have to make a profit, and which to do so have hordes of employees devoted to reducing the claims paid by their employers. That's why I like to refer to insurance companies as death panels. So when Republicans talk about saving Social Security and Medicare, they are lying. They don't want to save them. They want to get rid of them, so that health and retirement are entirely privatized, so that their donors and they themselves can profit off of the health care and retirement systems. Of course, the implication is that health care and retirement will simply be out of the financial reach of many people. But those are the people that need to take responsibility for their lives in Mitt Romney's world. So, too bad for them if they don't. Finally, a word about those 47%. It's been a while since those remarks were widely publicized, so many people probably have already talked about this that you've heard. Perhaps you've heard your fill, but I haven't said enough about this. I don't know if I can. But here goes. So 46.4% of tax filers end up owing no federal income tax. That's where that 47% number comes from. It's inappropriately rounded up even, but let's think about those people, those 46.4%. Many are retired, living on Social Security, so they've worked hard their whole lives and paid into the system, and now they're getting meager checks every month that, in many cases, is their sole source of support in their retirement. So even if they, even if Social Security benefits were eligible to be taxed on federal income tax, they still wouldn't have high enough income to owe any taxes, any federal income taxes. So that's a whole bunch. Many others are working but don't earn enough money in a year to have taxable income. their deductions and exemptions mean that their taxable income is zero. So I can't help but wonder if these are the deductions and exemptions, the ones that poor people get just like everyone else, are the ones that Romney and Ryan are thinking of when they talk about broadening the tax base, getting rid of exemptions and deductions in order to be able to lower the tax rate and yet still have the same amount of tax revenue flowing in. They won't say, though. And although Raddatz pushed Ryan to answer during the vice presidential debate, he wouldn't. And although Ryan denies it, and he knows he's lying when he says it's not mathematically impossible to get their debt reductions without going after broad-based deductions and exemptions, like the mortgage interest deduction or the personal exemptions. Of course, all of them pay taxes. All of the 47%, everybody pays taxes. Everybody who's working pays payroll taxes for Social Security and Medicare. Everybody pays sales taxes. Most people pay state income taxes. Many people pay property taxes, excise taxes, fees. Everybody pays taxes on their phone bills that you don't see. There are a whole lot of taxes that everybody pays, especially on gasoline, for example. So everybody pays taxes. I think it's the man who made $20 million last year for doing what exactly? And paid 14% in taxes. I think that's the one who isn't paying their fair share. That's the one who needs to stop feeling entitled. I'm here with John Friedman, Alderman of the 3rd Ward and Chair of the Legal Committee of the City of Hudson. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining me. We're here tonight to talk about housing in Hudson and a little bit about the current state of the law, any issues that came out of the meeting that you had last week, and anything else we can think of. So, could you start by telling us a little bit about the current state of housing law, so housing owner-tenant relations, et cetera?
Well, we have, I think, what is probably pretty standard housing law in the city of Hudson, but it has one inherent weakness, which is that violations are not cumulative, so that if you're violating one of the health and safety codes, yes, and it's not an inconsiderable amount of money. It's $250 a day, and each day is a separate occurrence, so it can rack up pretty fast. But it's only financial, and clearly, you know, because of the level of complaints and that are filed every month by the code enforcement office, there's a problem, and for some landlords it's simply a cost of doing business, but that's not enough.
Right.
It's not enough to pay the fine. The purpose of the fine is to make you fix the quarters so that your tenant is living in at least a clean, safe, well-lit, ventilated, non-fire trap-like place. And so we're trying to figure out how we change the law to address that particular issue. Another issue that we learned about at the hearing was how the code enforcement office is sometimes used by tenants against landlords.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that wasn't a particularly shocking revelation, but to hear the landlords and the code enforcement officer also discuss this and agree on it.
Yeah,
when they clearly don't agree on everything or an awful lot of things,
right?
Was somewhat, you know, was a revelation, I think, a little bit, and ratified that thought. And so one of the other things that we're looking at is potentially the addition of an inspection requirement, if there's noncompliance with a registration law, that would do a couple of things. Give us a really good sense of how many apartments are on the market,
mm-hmm.
and where they are. And it would also give us a sense of what the range of rents might be across there. And it would help us understand who's complying and who's not. And often, you know, it was at that hearing that we had a week or so ago, whenever it was, we didn't have any tenants there because tenants who lived in some of the buildings that might be classified as substandard were afraid of any retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, I was told, did not want to participate for that reason. So, you know, we want to try and alleviate that fear somewhat too.
Right.
You know, we are not looking at it as a revenue source for the city in mm-hmm. any sense. If there's a fee for the landlords, it would be just to cover the city's cost of sending somebody out.
Right.
So maybe $50.
Yeah.
And we're cognizant of the fact that it has to be done very quickly so that the apartment's not off the market for any period of time. And we're trying to understand how other municipalities answer that particular question and how we can do it here effectively. So it's not anything that's going to be resolved anytime soon, as we're still learning and thinking about it. And of course, we're essentially volunteer organization.
Sure.
We have a couple of professionals who work with us, our attorneys essentially, and the clerk's office. But otherwise, we find the time to do it as we can. And, you know, and most of this work is done at the committee level.
Right.
And the committee meetings is where we discuss a lot of it. Then the work is done in between the meetings by the members of the committee, myself, the city's attorney. Sometimes the city's attorneys are involved, and then some other expert agencies within the city who are professionals, police department, the code enforcement office, they contribute, their wisdom
mm-hmm.
And suggestions to us. And we try to incorporate those things into the drafts so that the laws are effective and are capable of being enforced in a reasonable basis.
Right. So just to be clear, the general idea that's under consideration is to have an inspection of a unit, an apartment that goes up for rent, so that it would have to be inspected to make sure that's that it meets code before it's available to be rented.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be done when it's a vacant apartment.
Right.
If the tenant gives permission, we could do it before. The city could do it before, so there is no downtime. And then, assuming that the landlord doesn't, file a claim against the tenant for damages, we would assume that the apartment was passed from, and there was no, problem raised by the new tenant. We would assume that the apartment is still up to code. And until we heard from somebody or there was a reason to go back in, as long as that apartment was registered every year, that this is an apartment. We don't necessarily need to know, as far as I can tell now, but maybe we'll want to know if it's vacant or if it's still occupied.
Mm-hmm.
but we wouldn't have any reason to go back in there unless there was a complaint, or a fire broke out, or mm-hmm. Building fell down, or a crack appeared in the wall, or some other reason that would generally and reasonably trigger an inspection. So, that's part of it. We're looking at that. I don't know that there's an awful lot of support one way or the other for that. It's just, we can see how it might solve some problems, but it creates other problems and it creates issues. And we want to make sure that the things that we do don't create any needless issues. Mm-hmm. We're trying to solve things, not create problems. So.
Right.
We got plenty of problems on our own without creating any. We try not to, but inevitably will piss somebody off.
So you said there's not a lot of support either way for this right now. So why is it going on? Why is the process, how did the process get started of reviewing the current law and seeing what could be?
A ceiling improved? Collapsed on a family last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that generated a bunch of complaints,
sure.
That the city wasn't doing anything and that there was a lot of substandard housing in the city. and that there was problems in this regard. So we were trying to find ways to make sure that ceilings don't fall on people's heads anymore.
Right.
So we decided we would look into this. And, you know, we had a new administration in City Hall with the mayor. And I'm a new chair of this committee this year, mm-hmm. And new to the council this year. And we just decided we would start from scratch. And rather than trying to fix what we have, we would look at what other types of towns our size, cities our size around the country are doing. And one of the things that a lot of them are doing is this type of inspection. And mm-hmm. they do it for the same reasons that we're trying to do it, which is to ensure that the housing stock is safe and does meet minimum standards of safety and fire safety, and that there are, you know, fire alarms and carbon monoxide alarms, and that they're working, and that mm-hmm. people are protected, and that surrounding properties are protected, and these aren't, you know, that there aren't fire traps. And as we learned at the hearing, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, I mean, a woman burned to death yeah. in a Hudson apartment because there hadn't been an inspection.
Yeah.
And if there had been an inspection law, that would have been found. And, you know, we don't know if that one would be alive today, but we know that she wouldn't have died for that particular reason. Yeah. You know, there's a problem. But it's not the only issue that we face in Hudson about housing. And I think that this is an issue. But, you know, another issue that we're becoming aware of more, I guess, is that there's a dearth of what you might call affordable housing.
Right.
And the cost of apartments has apparently been skyrocketing, hundreds of dollars a month going up. Mm-hmm. And we don't know why. And we don't know if there's anything anybody can even do about it except try and incentivize private developers to build more moderate income housing. Rental and potentially sale, you know, owned occupant-owned housing, but you know, we do know, and we're hearing anecdotally that there are a lot more younger people coming to Hudson, artists, musicians, and what have you, and they're looking for, you know, reasonably priced 1 and 2 bedroom apartments. And the number that we were quoted most recently was that a 2-bedroom apartment that was going for $1,000 at the beginning of the year was going for between $1,300 and $1,400 a month now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a comparable apartment, and that is putting it way above the available, you know, the reach of a lot of these younger people. And you know, we're the oldest county in New York
in terms of
median age. Columbia County.
Yeah.
And Hudson's not a young city either. And amongst most of my friends, I'm the youngest, and I'm no spring chicken myself. So that's just, you know, we're a graying population here. We need these younger people to come in and revitalize. We need their energy, and we need their desire to be here. And we, you know, need to at least try and figure out a way to make this town affordable. I mean, we need, it's a city, you need everybody. You need rich people, poor people, middle class. We need everybody. Blue collar, white collar, everything. You know? Otherwise, the city doesn't work. You can call it a city, but it's not really a city. We want it to be a city.
Sure.
So we have to make sure that we figure out why the price of apartments is moving up so fast. And we need to figure out a way to enable investors to build more apartments, which should hopefully bring that price down, and address different segments of the market. And we are. We're talking about some ideas and changing of zoning that might create a ability for more apartments to be built in the city. I happen to be on the board of Habitat for Humanity in Columbia County, and we're also talking about that within the city of Hudson, maybe starting to look at building multifamily dwellings as opposed to single family or attached housing as we traditionally have, because in a city, especially a really small city, density is desirable to some point, of course. I mean, you know, we don't, nobody wants, you know, 25-story tall apartment buildings scattered around the city or or in any particular area. I mean, we're talking about tearing down Bliss Towers. Personally, I don't know where that conversation is, but, you know, we're not talking about building new ones. But we are talking about ways to develop more more multi-dwelling units, more rental properties within the city, so that we can lower the median cost of housing and make it reachable for everybody who wants to be here.
Sure. You know, almost every time I think about doing a segment about the city of Hudson, you know, I think I should title it The Tale of Two Cities, right? Because it really seems to be, you know, a pretty clear divide between Warren Street and maybe parts of Union Street and the rest of the city. And whereas Warren Street is, you know, undergoing gentrification, right, especially, you know, below Third, right, whereas the rest of the city isn't, doesn't seem to be developing in the same trajectory, right? But so, you know, that process of gentrification, you know, in other areas, you know, in big cities like New York, you know, in Harlem or in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, you know, that follows a familiar pattern. You know, there's low-cost housing, so cool people move in, you know, artists, and so people who like to be around cool people start to move in who have more money, and, you know, that's what tends to happen. So, I mean, is there, not in terms of affordability, but in terms of volume, is there a shortage of rental space in Hudson at this point that's, you know, I mean, I'm an economist, so if I hear the prices going up, it's either, you know, supply or demand, right? And the thing with housing is supply, you know, doesn't shift much in the short run. But in the short run, demand can shift a lot. And
sure.
So if the price is going up, I think demand must be going up. So
I think, yeah, it's two things are happening. And you're right. I mean, I think of Hudson as three cities. You have Warren Street and everything south of it, the first ward and the third wards of the city, if you will. And those are clearly higher median income neighborhoods. The properties tend to have higher values than in other parts of the city, in the other parts of the urban Hudson, to the extent that we are urban. And then there's the north part and the second and fourth wards off of Warren Street. You know, Warren Street's a world unto itself.
Yeah.
And the second and fourth wards are inner city in a lot of respects in terms of the level of poverty and the multi-generational sharing of housing, the doubling up. And we hear, you know, this from Alderwoman Wanda Pertillo, who represents that district, and, you know, she insists, and I'm sure she's right, that there's an awful lot of this going on among families in her constituency, because the cost of housing,
right?
And you don't turn family away when you can't, when you can accept them in. So
sure.
You do. That's why we're have families, part of the reason anyway. And then there's the fifth ward and the boulevards, which are so much more suburban than the rest of the city,
right?
And also I think tend to be an older part, you know, more the traditional Hudson folks who were born here and raised their families here, and their parents may have been raised here as well, you know, multi-generational families. And I'm told that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when that was considered the suburbs, that, you know, to make it in Hudson was to move out to the boulevards, to the suburbs, and Michael Place and River Ledge, and, you know, and it's very nice up there, and the views are spectacular.
Sure.
But, you know, I think of it as three different cities, because a lot of the concerns of folks who live downtown, in whether in the first or the second ward, or they live slightly farther uptown in the third or the fourth ward, and the portion of the fifth ward, that small piece of the fifth ward that is here in this portion of town, geographically, The concerns of the folks who live in the other part of the more remote parts of the Fifth don't jibe mm-hmm. with the other parts of the city. So that's another complexity and another challenge, which is trying to craft solutions that work for the whole city, because everybody is as important as everybody else.
Right.
Nobody is better than anybody else, and so it all has to work. And you know, trying to craft the compromises and the understanding across these perceived needs, the spectrum of perceived needs and desires, mm-hmm. is, you know, that's, I'm not going to say we horse trade. We're really not politicians on the Common Council, or
mm-hmm.
we're, you know, retired this and retired that, and I'm a lawyer, and one guy works for, you know, a computer company, and another guy owns his own business, and
mm-hmm.
so it's we're just trying to figure things out and work it out amongst ourselves. We don't really horse trade. None of us have any horses to trade.
Mm-hmm.
And our ballywicks are not valuable, or, you know, there's just nothing there. So we just try to figure things out and work together and keep it civil as much as possible. It works most of the time. So, you know, and then there's the whole homeless aspect, the homeless housing aspect, which is something that I think everybody wants to see at least some thoughtful solution undertaken, some mm-hmm. project undertaken to do what the city has a moral responsibility to do, and do it in a way that works for the whole city.
Yeah.
And again, you know, the rights of no group can be paramount to the rights of any other. And it's a very small city geographically, and you know, siting is a tremendous issue. Forget about the NIMBY aspects or mm-hmm. the banana aspects. Just try to understand, you know, does it make sense to put that here given what's there? Well, we're so small
yeah.
and compressed that everything is kind of in everything else's radius. So yeah. it's difficult. And so there's been more talk about scatter site housing. And that may be preferable. I just started to learn last week of this concept called housing first,
mm-hmm.
which forgets about all of the traditional three-tiered, the current state-of-the-art three-tiered approach, which is tier one, which is an emergency shelter, tier two is supportive housing, and tier three is transitional housing to transition you back into the mainstream housing market, rather than doing all of those things and then wrapping all of those things with these different levels of services that are essentially cookie cutter in the sense that you go from tier one to tier two to tier three to graduation. Although they, you know, can be customized to each particular unit or, you know, individual or family units need in some way, rather than undertake all of those rather lengthy, very expensive processes that don't really get to the underlying issues until well into the process. You get these families and these individuals back into a permanent place, an apartment, a house, however it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's subsidized, clearly, because if they could do it without subsidy, you wouldn't have the issue.
Yeah.
But you do that first, and you get the unit stabilized, meaning there's a roof over the head, you know where you're going every night, you know where you're waking up in the morning, and in between those two times you are safe, and you're not worrying about your possessions or your personal safety. You have a home. And then address what brought you here initially. How do we make that not become systemic so that you don't become a recurring client of these particular social services agencies? So I'm just starting to learn about that. What I've been reading about in the newspaper, which is my only source of information about the Board of Supervisors, except for some conversations with some of the Hudson supervisors, but they're not on every committee that deals with these issues, is that it seems like the Board of Supervisors is stepping back as a whole from the more traditional approach
mm-hmm.
because it was so inflexible.
Right.
And we never really reached that point in the conversation at the Board of Supervisor committee meetings that took place prior to the brakes being put on this last round of potential decisions. That was really on the basis that I think it was withdrawn because the contract was very muddy. It was not a finished product, and they were ready to they thought they were ready to vote on it, but they really weren't.
Mm-hmm.
This is my own personal opinion. I think the official opinion was their attorney wasn't there that night, so he couldn't answer questions.
Uh-huh.
But I think that a lot of people in the audience, myself included, make a pretty compelling argument that there was just a lot of questions. There were more questions than answers in that document. And one of the only questions that was answered and definitively was exactly how much it was going to cost us,
mm-hmm.
which never could scale down. So no matter how successful we were at preventing homelessness through this traditional approach, our costs were only guaranteed to go up,
yeah.
never go down. I don't know if anybody thought that was a really great idea for the county's taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then again, to build a facility that was going to house as many, I think at one point it was up to 44 mm-hmm. units that they were looking to house there. And then it was back down to 19 at some point, and then it was up to 37. And I think it kind of hung out at 37 for a while. All this was in a week.
Mm-hmm.
That just kept going up and down. It was ping-ponging. And you really, you know, had to spend a lot of time and effort to track it. It was just not a good idea. And mm-hmm. there was no need for the county to commit at that level, at that time, to that plan. Mm-hmm. And I think that since then, there's been some cooling of the ardor for that plan on the Board of Supervisors. And that's just me parsing what I read in the newspaper and maybe talking to one or two of the supervisors. But
mm-hmm.
so the supervisors I know are low on the totem pole and don't really know what's going on. And the inner workings of the Board of Supervisors, since all of the supervisors I know are Democrats.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I just want to thank John Friedman for coming in to talk to us. Again, Alderman of the 3rd Ward and Chair of the Legal Committee. Thanks a lot for coming, John.
My pleasure, Tom.
And I hope we can get you back again for another segment at some point.
Very good.
Next month, when we'll hear perhaps some economic news from Turkey, where I'll be for 2 weeks between now and then. And as always, local, regional, national, and international economic news brought to you in plain English. Now go out and do the right thing. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the third Wednesday of every month or anytime online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook at Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist, on Twitter at YFNEconomist, or on Tumblr at YFNEconomist.tumblr.com. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, send it to me through one of those venues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM Hudson Catskill Acre and produced by Thomas Masterson. That's me. I'll talk to you next month.